This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. This week marks an anniversary in the annals of air piracy and terrorism that foreshadowed the events of 2001. It happened more than three decades ago.
On a September morning in 1970, in a coordinated move, a group of men from the Mideast forced the world to pay attention to their cause by simultaneously hijacking several commercial airplanes.
Three of the four planes were taken over. One hijacking attempt was thwarted when passengers overwhelmed the hijackers. Days later, hijackers struck again and took another plane.
The events of September 1970 pushed international terrorism to a new level of concern. Former CBS TV news anchor and commentator Walter Cronkite reported the story then, and he now recalls that time when the jet plane first became an instrument of international terror.
Swiss Air Flight 100 had taken off early Sunday afternoon from Zurich. It seemed like another routine run to New York, until, after about 40 minutes in the air, a passenger awoke from a catnap, glanced out her window, and saw something odd. If the plane was supposed to be flying west over French wine country toward the Atlantic, why was she looking down at snow-capped mountains? Moments later, she and 142 other passengers would learn why when a woman announced in English and Arabic that the flight deck had been seized and the plane had been rerouted on a course to Jordan. What they would not know for another several hours was the astounding and audacious scope of the plot in which they had been caught.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and John Sheehan in Amman.
Over the North Sea, over the German-Luxembourg border, and over the northern tip of Scotland, at roughly that same time, three other commercial aircraft had been seized in an unprecedented synchronous kidnapping that would involve more than 600 innocent people. Violence in the Mideast was growing so routine, my colleagues and I at CBS were beginning to think that nothing could surprise us. This was a shocker no one had imagined. While we worried about the shaky ceasefire between Egypt, Israel, and Jordan, guerrilla hijack teams struck four airlines
almost simultaneously. Three attacks succeeded. But Israeli security forces and crew members overwhelmed the team aboard an El Al flight, killing an Arab man and capturing his female companion, a veteran hijacker. The successful teams forced two planes, Swiss Air and Transworld Airlines, to an airstrip which had been carved into the desert near Amman, Jordan. There they wait tonight, ringed by guerrilla tanks and armor, and in turn, ringed by Jordanian army forces, each fearful of the first move.
The fourth attack Sunday ended just seconds short of disaster in Cairo. In Amsterdam that morning, two hijackers had been bumped from the El Al flight by Israel security. So they changed their plans and bought first-class tickets on Pan Am Flight 93. At 2:20 that afternoon, over Scotland, they burst into the cockpit with guns, and the plane was theirs. But the 747 was too big to land on the desert airstrip in Jordan. So instead, it headed for Beirut, and then on to Cairo as it was rigged for explosive charges en route. Crew members prepared for an emergency evacuation. And then, with 152 passengers aboard and the plane 100 feet above the runway, one of the hijackers lit the fuse. By the time the huge jet rolled to a stop, only 2 minutes remained for passengers to clear the plane. In one of the most remarkable documents of the crisis, one passenger recorded this tape of the landing instructions and escape.
Now, we're going to have plenty of time to do this here, but we want you to do this here as swiftly and as easily so that nobody will get hurt. Just pay attention to what your stewardesses at each door tell you. Go down to the bottom of the ramp and then get away from the aircraft.
We seem to be getting close to a final approach. It feels like the motors have throttled back and perhaps even the flaps are down. Everyone's calm, sitting in their seats, talking. No evidence of panic whatsoever.
We seem to be down. There's no bloody hurry about getting out as far as I can see.
The doors then opened and the passengers began sliding down the inflated ramp to safety.
Let's do it.
Stewardess is right behind me, waving her flashlight. She's going to push me right out the door, first shot she gets. Okay, the door is open. Well, how did they get out of the slipstream? It's just blowing really hard. Wow.
The last crew member ran clear of the wing just as the huge 747 split open in a searing orange fireball of flame and smoke. It was early Monday morning, September 7th.
Dawn is just breaking over the Jordanian desert. Here are the latest developments affecting the fate of 180 or so American and other hostages aboard those two hijacked jetliners in Jordan. The United States, through urgent consultations in Washington and elsewhere, is leading international efforts to secure the passengers' release.
While the Pan Am wreckage smoldered in Cairo, the Swiss Air and TWA planes sat in the broiling sun on an abandoned World War II training field in the Jordanian desert. The hijackers called it Revolution Airstrip, and then Liberation Airstrip. Tuesday passed quietly, and then on Wednesday, another bulletin from the Mideast. I could scarcely believe my eyes or conceal my shock when the teletypes flashed that the air piracy by Arab guerrillas continues.
Today, Palestinian commandos took over a British airliner, the fourth successful hijacking in as many days. The jetliner, carrying 113 persons, was forced to land at the Jordanian desert airfield already occupied by two other big planes, a TWA and a Swiss airliner. And the fate of the 190 persons aboard those planes is still uncertain.
With airports and aircraft around the world almost totally undefended, we were learning what a soft target commercial aviation had become in a new kind of warfare. Yet air piracy was hardly a new phenomenon. As a young United Press reporter, I had covered an early incident around 1936 when a hijacker took over a private plane out of St. Louis and then shot the pilot. But for three decades, such incidents remained rare. After Castro came to power in 1959, Cuba became a common destination. By 1970, there had been 188 successful hijackings in commercial aviation history, and 122 of them were to Havana. Then suddenly, Mideast hijackings began to soar, 30 in 1968 and 70 in 1969. At first, the object was transportation. Yet, apart from an occasional inconvenience, little was at risk. But now, with five jets attacked within 72 hours, we knew we had turned a corner into an era when planes flew at the mercy and convenience of outlaws prepared for mass murder.
The hijackings have triggered a shockwave of indignation and concern throughout the world. Even Nasser's Egypt has denounced the air piracy, charging that it will lose whatever support there is for the cause of the Palestinian refugees. But the Arab commandos say they're not concerned about world opinion, that their hijackings are a legitimate instrument of war against the Israelis.
Normally implacable political alignments were blindsided by the unexpected suddenness of events. 4 days went by before the Soviet press printed a single word of the news. It took that long before the Kremlin could decide what to think about it. When it did, it decided the hijackers were to be denounced, but Israel was to be blamed. No one took that second point seriously. Even Yasser Arafat condemned the kidnappings. By Wednesday, my colleague Dick Hoddlett reported a rare consensus at the United Nations.
The United Nations Security Council has just adjourned after a 12-minute meeting, having adopted an appeal for the release of all passengers and crews held as a result of the hijackings. The big complication was Algeria's determination to lay the case of the Palestine Arabs before the Council. The UN peace talks are shaky enough without that, and it was probably this consideration which moved the Council to a consensus without delay.
The consensus came on Saturday morning, September 12th, when the commandos blew up the three remaining planes in the Jordanian desert. In most of the United States, it was still September 11th, a date that seemed unremarkable in 1970. The passengers had been removed and all but 40 released. Long after the story had disappeared from the front pages, they were freed in exchange deals. If the story disappeared, though, the dilemma would persist. It was an ancient clash of political extremes, now complicated by a centralized technology that would prove highly efficient to manage but dangerously easy to sabotage. The hijackers were driven by fanaticism, which is the special gift of those with nothing to lose. The Israelis had everything to lose, a prospect that reduces the niceties of diplomacy to direct action. In between, the rest of the world was left with the thankless detail work of weighing moral and political judgments while finding its way through the crossfire. 33 years and a generation later, all we know for sure is what my colleague Eric Severide forecast that week in 1970. When the need for safety expands, familiar freedoms can only shrivel. For NPR News, this is Walter Cronkite.
John McDonough produced our story about the 1970 skyjackings, along with engineer Lorna White.